From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the creator of the TV show Freaks and Geeks talks about his own nerdy experiences growing up. Paul Feig has written a new memoir called Kick Me, Adventures in Adolescence. Feig also co-created last year's sitcom Undeclared about college freshmen. Also, the life and times of Muddy Waters, we talk with Robert Gordon about his new biography of the singer and guitarist who electrified the Delta Blues. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carol Van Dam. The move by President Bush to have Congress authorize a military strike against Iraq advanced another step today. The House International Relations Committee voted to approve such a measure. One dissenting voice on the Senate floor today came from Democratic Senator Robert Byrd.
Let us sober up. Let us sober ourselves. Let us take hold of ourselves. Let us move back from this engine of haste and destruction. This desire to get it over, this desire to get it behind us before the election.
Despite the West Virginia lawmakers' objections, Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle predicts the president will win broad bipartisan support on the Iraqi resolution sometime next week. Attorneys for New Jersey Republican Senate candidate Doug Forrester have filed an appeal with the U.S. Supreme Court over yesterday's controversial state Supreme Court decision. That ruling allows Frank Lautenberg's name to replace Robert Torricelli's as the Democratic Senate candidate on the November election ballot. Gene Dillard reports.
The court ruled it's in the public interest and the general intent of the election laws to preserve the two-party system by having both Republican and Democratic candidates. Democrats have been ordered to pay for printing of new ballots. Their attorney, Angelo Genova, was pleased by the court ruling.
The court's decision is well-balanced, and it's predicated upon a long history in this state and precedent in this state, which supports voter choice.
However, Republicans say they're outraged. Senate GOP candidate Doug Forrester has directed his attorneys to file an immediate request for a stay of the state court order with U.S. Supreme Court Justice David Souter, asking also that the nation's highest court overturn the decision. For NPR News, I'm Gene Dillard in Trenton, New Jersey.
The streets of Montgomery County, Maryland, a Washington, D.C. suburb, have more security tonight as law enforcement agents continue to search for suspects believed to have killed five people in a random shooting spree. From member station WAMU, Lisa Nuremberger reports.
Police say they believe they're looking for a highly skilled marksman who used one bullet in each of the murders. They believe a white delivery truck was used to commit the crimes, which began Wednesday night when a shot was fired into a craft store, barely missing a sales clerk. Within the hour, a man was killed in a nearby grocery store parking lot. The killings resumed Thursday morning. In one case, a man was shot at a gas station across the street from a police station. Other victims were shot outside a post office at another gas station, and one man was shot while riding his lawnmower. Police are offering a $50,000 reward for information leading to an arrest. Schools will reopen as usual Friday after being in lockdown mode all day. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Nuremberger in Montgomery County, Maryland.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Industrials fell 38 points to close at 77.17 in heavy trading of nearly 1.7 billion shares. The Nasdaq lost 21. This is NPR News. Louisiana residents are taking a beating from Tropical Storm Lily, which was downgraded from a hurricane this afternoon. President Bush has declared the entire state a disaster area. The storm is losing strength as it moves northward, but continues to pound southern coastal towns with heavy wind and rain less than a week after Tropical Storm Isidore drenched the region. About 500,000 people had moved to higher ground. A Milwaukee meat packer has expanded a recall to a total of 2.8 million pounds of ground beef. The company is closing the plant where the contaminated meat originated. From member station WUWM, Dan Spray reports.
MPAC Foods President Justin Siegel says the company has temporarily closed the Milwaukee plant, which produced the ground beef that's been linked to an E. coli outbreak. Last week, MPAC, which does business as Peck Meats, recalled more than 400,000 pounds in Wisconsin, Illinois, and Minnesota. The recall was expanded Wednesday to include all meat produced at the plant during an entire week. Siegel says the ground beef was sold in 5- and 10-pound tubes, mainly to food services, but he says it's also available in grocery stores. He says the company and the Agriculture Department continued to review the situation and decided to expand the recall. For NPR News, I'm Dan Spray in Milwaukee.
A top West African mediator says rebels have agreed to a ceasefire with the government of Ivory Coast, halting a rebellion that began 2 weeks ago. In that time, the insurgents seized control of nearly half of the country. The ceasefire is to be signed tomorrow. A team of West African ministers met with rebels in the country's second largest city of Bouake today. I'm Carol Van Dam, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing innovative approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America. On the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The short-lived but hilarious TV series Freaks and Geeks chronicled all the embarrassing things in the lives of unpopular kids in a Michigan high school in the early 80s. Fans of the show may suspect that its creator, Paul Feig, was kind of nerdy himself when he was growing up. His new memoir confirms those suspicions. It's called Kick Me, Adventures in Adolescence. In addition to creating Freaks and Geeks and writing many of the episodes, Feig co-created last season's sitcom Undeclared about college freshmen. He has acted in such TV series as The Drew Carey Show, Ellen, Sabrina the Teenage Witch, and It's Gary Shandling Show, and he acted in the films That Thing You Do and Zombie High. Let's start with a reading from the beginning of Paul Feig's new memoir, Kick Me.
There is no God. I mean, there can't be. Think about it. If there were, then things in life would have to be fair. There would be no suffering, there would be no war, there would be no poverty, and none of us would be born with last names that could make us the brunt of adolescent jokes for the entirety of our school careers. In a truly just universe, no child's last name would be Cox, Butts, or Seaman. No teenager would come from a family named the Hardens or the Balls. A young Richard Shaft wouldn't have to come home from school crying each day. An underendowed Lisa Titwell wouldn't beg her parents to let her finish her education at an all-girls school. And an adolescent Paul Feig wouldn't have had to endure hearing the letters E and I consistently taken out of his last name and replaced with the letter A. But alas, I did.
That's Paul Feig reading the opening of his new memoir, Kick Me. Now, as you point out just a little further down into your book, that, you know, a lot of kids didn't even know what the word fag meant. So even though you were being called Paul Feig, a lot of kids had no clue what that was supposed to mean. I know when I was growing up, people used the words fag, fruit, fairy, and always meant that a boy was a little effeminate. Beyond that, if it had any meaning, I don't think we knew about it.
No, I don't think they really did. I always think it must be something they heard from their fathers or from their older brothers, and it sounded like an insult, and people reacted like it was an insult, and so it just got hurled around. In my neighborhood, insults were used so oddly. For some reason, my father bought me this backpack for my books when I was in, like, second grade, and I would ride my bike to school, and there was these mean kids who, when I would ride by with that backpack, they would call me the N-word for some reason. And it didn't even make sense because I knew what that word meant. And it was like, because I have a backpack? And then if you wore white socks, you were a Polack. So there was some sort of school logic that nobody gave me the handbook on to figure out.
So would you do the whole sticks and stones thing, or would you, like, insult the person back?
No, I was never tough enough to insult them back. I would either try to make a joke and get them to laugh, and if that didn't work, I would just hightail it out of there, basically, to my nerdier friends who were in the same boat, and we would just do dialogue from Warner Brothers cartoons and be glad that we had no athletic ability and no desire to beat up other kids like everyone around me seemed to have.
Now, your memoir of adolescence really got me thinking about some things that I haven't thought about in a while. Like, you say you'd always liked girls ever since you were five. What does it mean to have a crush on a girl when you're five or six, when you're in first or second grade?
It's odd because you don't get the support of your peer group. I thought it was normal because I was just attracted to girls, and I would, you know, sort of tell that to one of my friends, and they'd give me this strange look, or like, ew, you like her? Why do you like her? And then cooties, the word cooties would generally come into play, which I don't know where the whole concept of cooties came from, but if somebody could have patented it, they would have made millions of dollars off of it. But you really felt alone in a weird way, because if you wanted to hang out with girls, it was looked at that you were being a sissy, or you were a girl or something, and so they never really caught on to it. Of course, then in later years, they surged past me very quickly, figured it out, and then actually figured what the next step was, as opposed to myself, who just became best friend to every girl I knew and the safe friend.
Now, you describe your earliest feelings of sexual arousal, and this was in gym when you were climbing the ropes, and you kind of accidentally got turned on by it. And I'm really interested in hearing you talk about that feeling of confusion and discovery, realizing that something quite sensational was happening to you. Was your impulse to, like, talk about it at the next show and tell in class, or to keep it a big secret, or to run and tell your mother and father, "You'll never guess what happened to me today"?
Well, first of all, that was a very sexy rope, I just have to say.
But it was
I knew something was happening that was probably a private thing. But on top of it, I had thought I sort of discovered something, you know, because I never talked about that sort of thing with anybody around me. And this was back, you know, this was in the late 60s when, well, I was going to say, I guess there wasn't a lot of sexual talk on television, although it was the sexual revolution. But still, it wasn't in the shows I was watching. There wasn't a lot of talk of orgasms on Bewitched or Gilligan's Island or any of those things. So I missed out on that. But I was so happy that I had found something that seemed to be pleasure giving that you didn't have to buy or pay for, other than at that moment I thought I had to climb ropes in gym class, which I didn't enjoy doing and wasn't particularly good at, but sure put my nose to the grindstone to try to get up that rope after that first time. It's odd. I don't my poor wife, she goes, "Boy, you were very honest in this book." To me, it was such there's few moments in your life where you have such an amazing discovery. I mean, there's times when you find a great restaurant you like, or you find a great book, or you discover a movie you've never seen. But to come across something that is so intense and life-changing as, for lack of a more discreet term, having your first orgasm, it's I just found it to be a profound experience. And once, it was almost disappointing once I found out that everybody experienced this, not particularly in gym class, but just as a species in general.
Was there a moment that you could put your finger on where you learned that you're supposed to feel that, you know, a lot of people were going to try to instill in you a sense of embarrassment and shame about this feeling?
Yeah. Oh, you know what it was? My family used to, my father owned this store, and he just worked constantly, but we'd always take a week off, and it was this big thing for us to go on a vacation, like to the Caribbean. He loved that. We lived in Michigan, and we wanted to go somewhere warm. So we were in the Caribbean, and we first got there, and we turned on a radio show, and there was this Caribbean, I think we were in Jamaica or something, interview show, and it was this religious show talking about masturbation, and it was all these things about how when you masturbate, you lose like a day off your life, and all these strange things about how it was going to kill you. And I remember my father looking over my mother and giving her this look, and she turned off the radio. And it was very confusing for me, because I thought, either they know I'm doing this and I'm shortening my life and they just don't want to, you know, they want to get rid of me, or it was something that was not true and needed to be shut off. But it was very odd, because I think after that I really carried this thing with me of, oh my God, maybe it's right. Maybe every time you do this this event, you're shortening your life. It's worse than cigarettes, because I heard cigarettes, you know, knock it like a minute or something each one, but this was a whole day. So there was a lot of tense moments as a young man, kind of bargaining away my life, going, okay, I don't need, if I'm 80, I probably won't need that day because it'll be a Sunday. So if I die on a Saturday, that's all right. And then, of course, very quickly bargain myself down to being about 30 years old, I think. So there you go.
Paul Feig is my guest. He created the TV series Freaks and Geeks. Now he has a new memoir of adolescence called Kick Me. When you created the characters for Freaks and Geeks, what traits from yourself did you give to the main characters?
I actually think there's a bit of me in each character. What you tend to do is, the way I like to work is kind of break up my personality a bit and sprinkle it around.
Well, let's look at the two main characters, the sister and the brother.
Yeah.
Why don't you describe each of them and tell us which of those traits came directly from your life or from people that you knew?
Well, to be honest, I always describe it as Sam Weir was me back then and Lindsay Weir is me today. Because I always feel, and people will always back this up, that teenage girls mature much quicker than teenage boys. And to the point of, I feel that teenage girls are probably at about the same emotional maturity level as guys in their 30s, because it takes us so much longer to catch up to you guys. But for Sam, it was just this kid who really just is trying to get through the day with his friends and the things he likes, and he's not athletic, and he feels a bit intimidated by the tougher kids in school and the more popular kids, but he has a crush on the most beautiful girl in the school, the head cheerleader, which I did too. I asked this girl to go to the homecoming dance the day of the homecoming dance, thinking for some reason she would be available. It was completely relieved when she wasn't, but at least I gave it a try. And then for Lindsay, it's just the character that questions things more. I was really into just kind of not accepting things as they were, as a lot of teenagers are, but I always found that teenage girls were a little less likely to accept things as they were, at least the ones I knew back then. And I just love the idea of an adolescent questioning things, questioning everything, questioning their religion, questioning what they're being taught, questioning popularity. And so for her to go over and hang with the freaks or the burnouts was something that I was doing back then, just because I found them to be more honest and more real.
My guest is Paul Feig. Here's a scene from his TV series, Freaks and Geeks. The main characters, Sam and Lindsay, are sitting around the dinner table with their mother and father. Sam is worried because his gym teacher just announced a new rule that everyone has to shower after class.
I don't want to get naked in front of other guys.
Well, who does? You know how many men have seen me naked in my lifetime? A lot. Do you think I'm comfortable with it? No, but I live with it.
I just don't want them to tease me.
Oh, who would tease you?
All right, look. Here's what you do. You tell them you're proud of your body. That'll show them.
Sam, you have a beautiful body. Doesn't he, Harold?
Yes, I just said he had a beautiful body.
Those other boys are probably just jealous. Lindsay, tell your brother what a beautiful body he has.
Mom?
Mom?
Lindsay?
What?
Your mother asked you to tell your brother that he has a beautiful body.
That is so stupid.
Lindsay, tell him.
It's not going to help him.
Lindsay, just say the words. It'll make him feel better.
Sam? You have a beautiful body. You're an Adonis, a slab of beef. If I wasn't your sister, oh my God.
Lindsay, can it?
See, sweetheart?
We'll talk more with Paul Feig after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Paul Feig, the creator of the TV series Freaks and Geeks. He has a new memoir called Kick Me, Adventures in Adolescence. Were there any pressures on you when you were doing Freaks and Geeks to smooth out the rough edges of any of the characters?
Oh, yeah. The head of the network at that time, I remember, had a lunch with Judd Apatow, the exec producer, and basically said, can't these kids ever win? Can't they have a victory? Like, it drove him crazy that we had one episode where Sam Weir finally goes on a date with the head cheerleader, and when they're at the restaurant, this head the head football player walks in, and she basically confides in Sam that she's in love with him, and ends up by saying, "I love talking to you. You're just like my sister," and it just drove him crazy. He was like, he's on a date with a cheerleader, and she talks about another guy. Can't he have a successful victory? And for, it's like, no, he can't, because A, then what's the series? And B, that's not how life works out. If I went out with the cheerleader, a head cheerleader, and she said she loved me, well, then my whole life would have been different, and it wouldn't have occurred, because those kind of things in my world never occurred.
I want to mention that you told me right before we started taping that your father died a couple of days ago. And first of all, I want to say how sorry I am about that. And second of all, I think it must be, you're very affectionate toward your parents in the book, even though, I mean, you're making fun of the whole experience of adolescence, which includes, you know, having some laughs at how, some laughs at your relationship with your parents, but you obviously are very affectionate about them in the book. And I think it must be a strange time to be having your book published and to be talking about all this, having just lost your father.
Yeah, it is odd. I mean, he's been sick with Parkinson's, but for a while. But he was not doing badly. So it was still quite a surprise. But I really wished he could have at least made it to the book coming out, because his picture's on the front of it. And I kept saying to him, you know, you're gonna be not famous, but I said you're gonna be in bookstores all over the country. Your picture. So you gotta get ready. And we joke about that. But it is sad. I mean, I love my parents. So many artists, and especially people who do comedy, are very down on their parents or had bad childhoods or say they did and are really at odds with their parents. And I just didn't have that experience. My parents were very supportive of me. My mom just loved the idea that I was leaning towards doing something creative. And my father, who owned this army surplus store, desperately wanted me to take it over, but I was an only child also. And he saw the writing on the wall, and it was more important to him the ethic of you must be happy in your work than it was you have to do this because, you know, it's the family business or you can't let this go away. And so I feel that's the greatest thing both my parents gave me is an acceptance and a love of life and a love of doing what you love to do.
You mentioned that your father is on the cover of your book, and you wish that he'd been alive to see it in bookstores. This is a great picture. I mean, if anybody ever challenges you and says, "Were you really a geek in high school?" All you have to do is show them the cover of this book, and you know, exactly. What other proof would anybody require? Can I ask you to describe this photograph?
Yeah, this photo is the reason I put it on the cover of the book. Is this is a photo that would sit seriously in our house for years, and not one person ever looked at this and didn't laugh, because first of all, it's three conflicting hairstyles. My father was completely bald. My mother had hair the size of a watermelon, and I had this sort of mock John Denver meets, I don't know, some other hair disaster. John Denver meets That Girl, I guess. And we're all posed very nicely in a nice studio setting, me with my spicy new jean jacket on that I'm sure I thought made me extra cool, and until I walked out of the studio and probably was immediately beaten up in it. What I love about this picture is it just shows how clueless one can be, because it's just we just look happy, and I look like, hey, everything's great, and you know, clearly things were not great outside of the house. I had great friends, but you know, it was there's that movie Welcome to the Dollhouse, which is so funny because it starts with a push-in on this family portrait, and everyone looks so happy, and to me that just kills me, because you know, there's the two worlds you live in, and if you come from a nice household, there's the happy womb-like environment that you're in there, and then you're just immediately every day spit out into the real world, and you kind of at night you reset, like you know when you wake up in the morning and you kind of wake up and you forget the problems of the past day for a little bit, and you feel like it's a reset button, and the minute you walk out of the house and you get to the bus stop or you get to work or whatever, and it just starts wearing you down every day. But that's why I love pictures like this is like the reset button was hit and everyone's happy for the moment.
how Do you think the adult Paul Feig is influenced by the adolescent Paul Feig? I mean, you're pretty successful now. You've had a TV series. You're directing a movie that you're editing now. You know, you've got a new book. You know, you've done okay for yourself so far. In your book about adolescence, you describe being afraid of everything, even Ronald McDonald, and Robin and the Seven Hoods scares you in the movies. I mean, are you still as afraid and self-conscious and inhibited as you were as an adolescent?
No, I'm not. I've actually kind of swung the other way, where I'm there's not. This sounds so cavalier, but there's not a lot that scares me now. And what I find is I don't have patience for adults who get scared of things, because I worked through it. It was odd. I mean, I was literally afraid of everything when I was a kid, from thunder to dogs to anything. And at some point, I just realized I wasn't able to do anything. And I think it was right around when I was about halfway through high school, I just said to myself, you can't go on this way. It's ridiculous. You're going to cut yourself out of so much life. And there was so much stuff that I wanted to do. I always got really inspired by things I would see. Like, if I saw a movie, I wanted to be a movie actor and I wanted to direct a movie. If I saw a TV show, I wanted to have a TV show. If I read a book, I wanted to be an author. If I saw a play, I wanted to be Will Shakespeare. The good thing about all that was it made me do a lot of things, and it forced me to have to break out of who I was, because the only way you could do those things, you couldn't just really sit in your room and do those outside of writing, but you had to get out and experience things. And so I've really come full circle on it. But that said, you know, it's really hard to divorce yourself from who you were. And I'd hate to forget that, because I love those feelings of back then. I love trying to remember what that intensity of being in love with somebody when you were a teenager, that crush where it's just you feel like there's a wrench in your chest. I just, to me, it's such pure emotion, and it's really beautiful. And even though it was tough back then, to lose that, you know, there is a sense of loss about having your emotions dulled a bit.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you, Terry. It's been really a pleasure.
And I'm sorry again about your father.
Well, thanks. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Paul Feig is the author of the new memoir, Kick Me, Adventures in Adolescence. He created the TV series Freaks and Geeks. You can see the reruns on the cable channel ABC Family. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's another scene from Freaks and Geeks in gym class.
All right, simmer down, Petunias. Let's go. We got a busy week ahead of us. It's time to start training for the president's physical fitness test.
Jimmy Carter's a wimp!
Hey, can it, White? Now, we're going to start on upper body strength with a little rope climbing.
Yeah, that's going to help us get into a good college.
All right, fellas, one more thing. New district policy, everybody must take a shower after class starting today. And, hey, look, I'm going to be checking for wet hair, so don't think you can pull a fast one.
We're allowed to shower with this because he's a woman.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And Wiley, publishers of Turning Points, a new book series featuring Columbus in the Americas by author William Least Heat Moon, now at your local BookSense bookseller or wherever books are sold. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the life and times of Muddy Waters. We talk with Robert Gordon about his new book, Can't Be Satisfied, a biography of the singer and guitarist who electrified the Delta Blues. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Robert Gordon, is the author of a new biography of blues guitarist and singer Muddy Waters, the musician who electrified the Delta blues. Muddy Waters grew up on a plantation on the Mississippi Delta and moved to Chicago as a young man. He not only took the blues in a new direction, he influenced rock and roll. Gordon writes, his song Rolling Stone inspired a band name and a magazine. When Bob Dylan went from acoustic folk music to rock and roll, he hired white musicians who'd learned from Muddy in Chicago. Songs that Muddy wrote or made famous have become mainstream hits when performed by Led Zeppelin, Jimi Hendrix, Eric Clapton, and plenty of others. Robert Gordon is also the author of It Came from Memphis and The King on the Road. He directed the blues documentary All Day and All Night. His new documentary on Muddy Waters will be shown on PBS stations in June. Here's Muddy Waters, recorded in 1950.
Well, you know, you leave home in the morning, you don't come back. You don't come back until night. You won't cook me no food, and you still say you treat me right, but hey, you gonna need. You're gonna need my help, I said. Well, you know, I won't have to worry. I have everything, little girl, coming my way. No, I ain't gotta worry about it no more, man. All right, little Walker.
Robert Gordon, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with just summing up Muddy Waters' musical importance. Would you do that for us?
Okay. I think his great musical contribution is sort of juicing the blues and creating the foundation for rock and roll. He started in the Delta in the South on an acoustic guitar, and in the 40s went to Chicago where an acoustic guitar couldn't be heard in the clubs, and adapted the Delta blues style and the feeling of the Delta blues and put it first to an electric guitar and then into a full band. And when they started doing that faster in the 60s, they called it rock and roll.
You've put together some tracks that are well known and some that are obscure. So let's listen to what is, I think, a pretty obscure Muddy Waters recording. This is from 1941. Before he started plugging in, and
right.
It's a well-known song of his, I Can't Be Satisfied. What should we be listening for in this 1941 recording?
Well, this is the first time he's going to hear himself back, which is an interesting thing to think about. He gets the validation from hearing this that he can do it. And what I think you hear in these early recordings, In his type of blues, you can hear the work, you can hear sort of, there's like blues like Robert Johnson where you hear kind of the field hand playing hooky. He's not at work. In Muddy, I think you hear the work. And so you can just kind of, I think this evokes the field very clearly.
So here's Muddy Waters, recorded in 1941, recorded by Alan Lomax.
Like I feel today, I'm gonna pack my suitcase and make my gear. I'm out of trouble, I'm all right. And I never be satisfied, and I just can't keep up. Yeah, I know my little baby, she gonna jump in.
Muddy Waters recorded in 1941. Muddy Waters was first recorded by folklorist Alan Lomax. Lomax made that 1941 recording that we just heard of, I Can't Be Satisfied. How did Lomax find out about Muddy Waters?
It actually goes back to this fire in Natchez in, I believe, 1940 at a nightclub where there was a black society ball. And because people were going to be trying to crash the party, they locked the doors at the club. And when the club caught on fire, there was no escaping. It was this horrible, horrible fire. And this African-American musicologist at Fisk University, a black school in Nashville, knew that a year after that fire, there would be a new folklore about it, that there would be songs written. And he wanted to go down to Natchez and record that new material. And in the course of appealing for funds, Fisk went to the Library of Congress, and that's where Alan Lomax got wind of the project and saw the importance of it. It ended up that the timing was such they couldn't get to Natchez, but they chose Coahoma County, which is where Clarksdale is in Mississippi, because it had a very dense African-American population. And they went down there in 1941 and 42 to investigate the role of music in the culture there.
And that's where he found Muddy Waters.
He found Muddy Waters and Honey Boy Edwards and Son House and just a whole slew of great recordings.
You describe what Muddy Waters' reaction was after Alan Lomax played back Waters' first recording. What was his reaction?
He hears himself, you know. He's got all these 78s in his cabin that he's heard, and when he hears himself back, he goes, "Man, I can sing."
So he was pleased with what he heard.
Yeah, he was pleased. I think he was astounded.
My guest is Robert Gordon, the author of a new biography of Muddy Waters called Can't Be Satisfied. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Robert Gordon, is the author of the new biography, Can't Be Satisfied, The Life and Times of Muddy Waters. Robert Gordon, let's jump ahead 7 years when he makes this song again and records it commercially. What's the difference between the two versions?
Essentially, what we're going to hear in this is what I call amplified Delta blues. That is, he's now been given an electric guitar, and begun to figure it out. He hasn't created what will soon be called Chicago blues or urban blues or city blues. And instead here, it's the Delta style that we just heard with a little more power. I think you can feel the kind of tractor seat bounce in that song that we just heard and that we'll hear now. I just imagine him in a seat, either on a tractor or behind a plow, and I think there's the rhythm of those wheels and the furrowed field. I think all of that is right here.
Here's Muddy Waters in 1948. Can't Be Satisfied.
And I just can't keep on. Well, I feel like snapping pistol in your face. I'm gonna let some graveyard Lord be her resting place. Woman, I'm trouble, I be all wood mine. Well, baby, I can't never be satisfied, and I just can't keep on. Baby.
If I can I talk a little more about that song?
Can't be satisfied?
Yeah.
Sure.
Because that when he makes that recording, you know, on which basically his career is built, because Can't Be Satisfied comes out and it takes off. You know, he's established. It comes out on a Friday. It sells out over the weekend, which was very rare. And all of a sudden he's a name, you know, and then his career is going. That was recorded at his third session with Leonard Chess in Chicago. And at each session, it was Muddy Waters on guitar and a piano player. And you can hear where the guitar is about to break into modernity, and the piano gets in the way. You know, like, Leonard knew the old style. That was all he knew. And so when this third session is about to be done, Muddy speaks up and says, "Hold it. Let me do one my way." And because, you know, the results hadn't been great so far, Leonard says, okay. Muddy goes back out, no piano, you know, just him and a bass player now. And that's when he records this sound. And that is when Leonard's in the studio going, what's he saying? You know, he can't even get it. He can't get the sound or even understand it. And when it, and there was a lady partner in the business at that time, Muddy always appealed to the ladies, and she got it. She said, no, we got to put that out. And it gets, you know, leapt on right away by the Chicago people who thirsted for that sound.
Well, we've already heard that recording to which you just referred. Let's listen to another recording that Muddy Waters makes pretty early in his stay in Chicago. This is from 1950. And this is Rollin' and Tumblin', which has since been covered many times. What do you find remarkable about this recording?
Well, this is recorded upon their return to Chicago in 1950, after he's enjoyed some success. He and Jimmy Rogers, who was his guitarist, and Little Walter, who was the harmonica player, and Babyface Leroy on drums, they say, you know, man, we made it. Let's go home triumphant. And that's when they go back and do this tour in the South, and they get a program on KFFA where they'd heard King Biscuit Time, you know, in their youth. And they come back north, and Leonard Chess at Chess Records will not record the band. He's very, you know, he's got a successful thing. He didn't like to change, and Muddy was all about change. So the band went to this competing recording studio, and I think and they laid down this track, and in it I think you can hear, you know, the excitement of their triumphant return home, and they're back in the north, and you know, the world is theirs, and they're just enjoying it. Very, very sexual, what we'll hear too, which I think is you know, at the core of the blues. You'll hear no words essentially here. This is just power.
Well, let's hear it. Recorded in 1950, Muddy Waters. Muddy Waters, recorded in 1950, Rollin' and Tumblin'. And my guest, Robert Gordon, is the author of a new biography of Muddy Waters called Can't Be Satisfied. Well, as you were explaining, Muddy Waters recorded that for a record label that wasn't Chess, because the Chess, Leonard Chess of Chess Records, didn't like the sound of it. But then Leonard Chess decides to record that song. What happened?
Chess was really the power in the market at the time, and that record came out. It didn't have Muddy's name on the label, but his sound was all over it. It was very clear who it was. It came out under the name of variously either Little Walter, the harmonica player, or Babyface Leroy, the drummer. And I love that drum in there. It's just like, you know, it's punk rock. 16th notes, just constant. And so Chess says, hey, you know, this is starting to take off. You come over here and do it for me. And they record a much cleaner version that doesn't have that same kind of frenzy to it. And it doesn't have the band either. But at that point, after that, Leonard Chess begins to bring in other bandmates because the audience response to that version of Rolling and Tumbling indicated that the audience was ready for a band.
I'm going to skip ahead to 1951, to a recording called Still a Fool. And you say that this recording really exemplifies what's going to happen with the use of electric guitar. I talk a little bit about this 1951 recording and the new sound that Muddy Waters is getting in it.
This is the beginning of urban blues. This is the beginning. This is when the electric guitar is no longer playing amplified Delta blues. This is a new sound. This is not a sound that they heard or could have made in the Delta. Listen to the power in the electric guitar, the crunch of the strings. Again, this is, I think it speaks for itself, really. But you'll hear, I mean, from here, this is where, this is essentially the foundation of modern blues.
Let's hear it. Muddy Waters, recorded in 1951, Still a Fool.
Well, that's two. That's two trains running. Well, ain't now one hole going my way. Well, now one run at midnight, the other one running just for day. They're running just for day. It's running just for day. Oh, Lord. Shown off the hill. Oh, well. Ho, ho. Somebody help me.
Muddy Waters, recorded in 1951. My guest, Robert Gordon, is the author of a new biography of Muddy Waters called Can't Be Satisfied. That's a really pretty great recording. Do you think his singing changes as his guitar playing changes?
That's funny because right in that song, I think you hear the guitar playing so entwined with the singing, and they both have that... it's almost like a distortion, you know, that rattle, that deep-chestedness. So I guess in a way it does. You know, the guitar sound essentially pulls him into this new kind of singing. Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that. But there, I think there it is, you know. That's where they're both entwined and they're both going. This is like new, and I just, I love hearing that song. I could hear that song all day.
My guest is Robert Gordon, the author of a new biography of Muddy Waters called Can't Be Satisfied. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Mm-hmm.
My guest Robert Gordon is the author of the new biography Can't Be Satisfied, The Life and Times of Muddy Waters. One of the things you did for the biography of Muddy Waters is find some of his surviving friends and surviving relatives. Who are the surviving relatives that you were able to make contact with?
I made contact and became friends with Muddy's brother, his half-brother, in Rolling Fork, Robert Morganfield, and his granddaughter, whom he raised, Amelia Cookie Cooper. And through them, really, once I met them and gained their trust and developed a rapport, I began to get beyond the stage and beyond the recording studio. It was easy to find bandmates, and they were happy to talk. But getting into the family, they took me inside the home. And Cookie, especially the granddaughter, she was raised by Muddy and his wife, lived with them since she was three in 1959. And I knocked on her door. She was expecting me. She opens the door and says, essentially, I told you I would talk to you, so come in, but I don't really want to talk to you. And I had waited about a year and a half or 2 years into my research to approach her because I wanted to go in educated and armed. And once I began to ask, you know, detailed family-specific questions, she opened up, and she said that Muddy, you know, was not a great man in the house, that, you know, she talked frankly about his womanizing and about the effect that had on his wife and in the household and on Cookie. And she laid it all on the line. She spoke very honestly. And that gave me, her doing that was a huge inspiration to me. Because it gave me, there is a dark side to Muddy Waters. In the foreword to the book, Keith Richards writes, there's a demon in all of us. And certainly there was a demon in Muddy. And her frank and forthright account of it allowed me to approach it similarly in the book.
Well, there's certainly a lot of darkness in his lyrics and a lot of sexuality in his lyrics. So I guess in that sense, it's not surprising that there was darkness and a lot of sexuality in his life as well. How did it affect your sense of him as a man to hear stories of his womanizing and of other things that he did that I imagine were dark or offensive to you?
I was on this book. It took me 5 years to write because it was, you know, because he didn't read or write. There was no filing cabinet I was going to find that had the box with his journal and all the answers in it, you know. So it took going around and finding the people. And in that 5 years, I went from, you know, really liking him to there was a period where I really didn't like him.
Did it affect your feelings about his music? Because let's face it, a lot of his songs are about having sex with women who you are not married to and who may be married to other people or you may be married to another person.
She said, come on in now, Muddy. My husband just now left. That's from Rolling Stone. In the 5 years, I never tired of listening to the music. And I think what this sort of understanding of his... of his understanding of his sexuality, what that gave me was, I think, you know, I began to examine the lyrics deeper and kind of feel the sex in the songs deeper.
Why don't we close with a recording of Muddy Waters singing his song, Mannish Boy. What's the significance of this recording?
Well, you know, the sexuality here, again, is very clear. And several people in Muddy's family talked about that when he would sing this song, he brought a voice, you know, he threw his whole self into it, which I think was part of his art. You know, there's a lot of people who sound great, but he was able to make it work on tape time and time again. So I think what you hear here is Muddy Waters singing, you know, I'm a man, and when I asked Cookie, the granddaughter, once, you know, why do you think he did these bad things to the home? And she said, because he's a man. And, you know, that kind of left me stunned. But, you know, in this song, I think you'll hear it.
Robert Gordon, his new biography of Muddy Waters is called Can't Be Satisfied. I'm Terry Gross.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Everything gonna be all right this morning. Oh, yeah. At the age of five, my mother South gonna be the greatest man alive. But now I'm a man, way past 21. I want you to believe me, baby. I have lots of fun. I'm a man.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Cloud of Sparrows, a debut novel of 19th century Japan by Takashi Matsuoka. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Vintage Books, publishers of the new paperback Uncle Tungsten, Memories of a Chemical Boyhood by Oliver Sacks, author of Awakenings. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Bill Paxton. He made his directing debut last spring with the film Frailty. He also starred as a father who believes God is telling him to kill people who are evil. Paxton was also in the films Twister, One False Move, and A Simple Plan. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Lee Brewer and Meredith Monk.